This is the Shogun Podcast on TV Podcast Industries. We're back with Shogun Chapter 7, A Stick of Time.
What happens if he surrenders?
He will be marched to Osaka and forced to grovel at Ishido-sama's feet. Toranaga-sama will be sentenced to death. And half his men will commit seppuku of allegiance to him.
My Rasmus is still moored in that cove. If you could get me the clearance I need to go aboard, then tonight I could go below, test the bilges. Easy dive over the side, check the keel. She'll need careening and scraping. Yabushige's men could help with stepping the spare bowsprit in the hold. I fix the sail myself. And then we could be out of that channel and we could...
What could we do, Anjin-sama?
Anything is better than standing here pissing around.
Welcome back, fellow warriors, to TV Podcast Industries. We're talking about Shogun, Chapter 7, A Stick of Time. I'm one of your hosts, Derek.
Hello there, fellow warriors. I am one of your other hosts, John. Yes, a stick in time saves nine.
It does.
I mean, a stitch in time saves nine.
That's right. I was trying to work out what a stick of time was for most of this episode.
Until it actually happened. Yeah.
I was like, is it a candle? Because a candle burns for quite a long time. So it could be like 6 hours of your time.
But, well, I like that. I don't think I ever have recalled that kind of process that you have a stick of my time.
I like it though.
Yeah, I did. Certainly for someone who's very busy, it's kind of like saying, right, you've got this long.
Exactly.
Perfect.
However long it takes for that to burn down, that's all we have to talk about it. But I think we'll be talking for a little longer than a stick of time here on this podcast, because there's a lot that happens in this episode. It's a very bad time this week in Azura Village, isn't it?
It certainly is, yes. Basically held hostage, really, from the surrounding troops of Toranaga's half-mongrel brother, old Nobutatsu.
Yes. Interesting to meet Nobutatsu and everything that's going on. But of course, we're going to spoil all that as we go into our discussion about this episode of Shogun. Just a reminder to go and make sure that you've subscribed to the podcast over on TV Podcast Industries. You can find that in any good or evil podcast player, or pop on over to our website at tvpodcastindustries.com. You can subscribe to the main feed or any of the feeds. The reason why I say the main feed is because you can get access to all of the other shows that we're podcasting. We're doing 3 podcasts a week at the moment with Shogun, Star Wars The Bad Batch, the final season of that animated Star Wars show, and also the end of the second season of Invincible, a hyper-violent TV show over on Prime Video. So go check those out if you have any interest in catching up with our animated discussions on those animated shows. But this one isn't animated and is quite brutal. And very adult.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. And it's fantastic. It's great to be back after a break. We did up to episode 6 through the screeners that we got. Yeah. And now we are going episode by episode till the 10th and glorious episode.
Yes, but are still very lucky to have our screeners in advance. So we're able to record ahead of time.
We got them back again.
We did get them back the last 4 episodes. So looking forward to talking about those. But we do still want to hear your feedback. We want to hear from you, what your thoughts on Shogun. The big difference, I suppose, since the last time we recorded is it's all out there now. People have been watching it and wow, it's hitting hard. People are loving it.
Yeah, they are. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's going down really well and rightly so. It's such a great show. Really, really exciting every week with everything that's going on, all the movements and machinations in Japan.
Well, it's all that kind of cunning and, as you say, the machinations, all the kind of doublespeak, the subtlety of it, so good. Yeah. I love the dialogue. I love all the kind of plotting and scheming that's going on. Mm-hmm. All these powerful individuals sort of butting up against one another.
Oh, yeah.
Really good. Yeah. But the
dialogue is so good that John actually asked me to take a quote from this episode from the discussion between Jin and Toranaga, and I had to point out to him that it's in Japanese and it wouldn't work very well at the start of our English-speaking podcast. So,
well, that is true. But maybe we put it at the end, because even that is just, it's lovely.
It is. It is lovely, yes.
And I think it's real cornerstone of this episode, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will talk about it.
To be honest, I think Jin with Toranaga and indeed Blackthorn, for kind of slightly different reasons, but certainly the same element is there. I think Jin says cunning and Blackthorn says trickery,
mm-hmm.
you know, but really, really good observations from these two that are kind of outside of his inner circle.
Well, yeah, exactly. Or maybe have made it into his inner circle after this episode anyway. But let's get into our discussion about this episode of Shogun.
Yes. A Stick of Time. Derek, who gave us what, when, where, how, and why?
Well, the show, of course, is based on the James Clavell 1975 novel of the same name. The show was created for television, of course, by Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. The writer of this week's episode was Matt Lambert. His second episode of Shogun, had he also wrote episode 5, Broken to the Fist. And this episode was directed by Takeshi Fukunaga. He's directed 2 episodes of season 2 of Tokyo Vice, a series that's also getting some massive praise coming out of Japan at the moment. So really intrigued to see that when we get it available over here. I couldn't find it on TV over here. So hopefully it's coming soon, because I've heard great things about it.
Yeah, definitely.
It'd be really good. John, do you want to tell us what they gave us with the synopsis for Shogun Chapter 7.
Sure. Outplayed by new alliances in Osaka, Torinaga is forced to carve out a new deal with a long-lost family member.
I would say you could probably switch those 2 sentences around and say, you know, Torinaga's forced to carve out a new deal with a long-lost family member and is still outplayed by alliances in Osaka in this episode, yeah? Feels like it starts that way and ends by the end of the episode as he's been outmaneuvered once again by the new alliances that are in there, doesn't it?
I guess so.
Or is he? Yes.
Or is he? Is the question, you know, yeah. Is he, isn't he? You know, because I think that's the importance of his sticking time with mm-hmm. Jin.
Yes.
And also the kind of defiance of John Blackthorn as Torinaga is submitting to Nobutatsu, his half-brother, to go to Osaka. You know, that outburst is one of the observation of John Blackthorn as to maybe what is really happening here. So, I think it ultimately all spins on a top, really, at the end with what happened. And because of that, you know, you just know, and looking forward to episode 8 then, sees how that plays out. So yeah, I think let us get into our top Bushidos for episode 7 of Shogun, A Stick of Time.
Yes, let's start out with Bushido 1, the arrival of Sakai Nobutatsu, the half-brother of Torinaga.
Yes, the mongrel, indeed.
Well, yes, he does call him that at one point.
I love all this kind of sort of disparaging remarks from Torinaga to Hiramatsu around this half-brother, you know, obviously away from his face. But yes, the arrival of his half-brother.
Yeah, he's super polite to him as he arrives. You know, this idea that obviously after losing so much of his army in the earthquake, that he has to reach out to his half-brother who he hasn't spoken to in a very long time, as Hiramatsu says, probably too long to be calling on him for aid. But that opening moment, it does feel like he's extending this hand of potential friendship and trying to reignite their relationship between these two that don't seem to have gotten on very well. There's an interesting line from Nobutatsu who kind of sums up the situation, saying things have gotten so bad that you summon the vast legions of your mediocre brother. So he knows, or he feels he knows, what Torinaga actually thinks of him.
Well, that's it. I mean, it's then complete charm offensive, you know, that he gets Kiku hired for a week to be effectively Nobutatsu's courtesan for the week and to give him pleasure. He is, you know, before the proposal, that official proposal, they're going to share those stories, you know, get good and drunk, I think they say, you know, can take in the hot springs of the area. It really is a charm offensive as to whether it's going to be wasted on him, because I do feel as though Sakai is very clued in to see that this is a move that at least outwardly looks desperate because of the decimated army, which, you know, he has noticed in riding in to the Ajira area. And, he, you know, he's in no doubt that in some ways he is also being used here.
Oh, absolutely.
I think he probably understands Torinaga. Not to say that he's breached that inner wall of his to know his exact thoughts.
He doesn't know his third heart, I don't think.
No. But I think he understands the level of Torinaga here in terms of how he plays the game.
I agree, yeah, absolutely. But I also think the charm offensive does slightly work, because we do hear over dinner that Nobutatsu is looking for the offer and wondering what it could be. Could he potentially be Lord of Isu, because he likes this place so much and the springs seem to be quite good. Kiku's obviously doing her job quite well, and he's kind of going, oh, well, maybe I could take over this whole area. I do like there's a little look over at Yabushiga, who's sitting at the dinner table, and he kind of gives this look of, hang on a second, is he looking to take over my lands now for me?
Yeah, exactly.
Which I thought was very interesting. But that dinner scene where we have him at the head of the table beside Toranaga, his brother, as he's sharing these stories, but they start to get less respectful of Toranaga and his achievements, and more of the brotherly kind, where it's, do you remember that time you crapped your own pants and had to ride a horse for 10 miles? And then realizing that he's surrounded by all of Toranaga's men who are not laughing at the jokes at their lord's expense.
Absolutely.
He kind of pulls it back and goes, oh, I mean, just at how far you've come since that time. Yeah.
Let's stare down at our bowls of sake, mm-hmm. kind of thing, as they're swigging away. Yeah. No, I love this. I kind of did like just the exchange of stories, even with Nagakado. You know, it's a long time since he's seen his nephew, and it's like, you know, your chin was as hairless as your balls the last time I saw you, you know, all this. Nagakado is kind of thinks this is great, you know. Talk more, uncle. Give us all these stories. You know, he's really excited, actually, that his uncle is here.
Thinks
that this alliance is absolutely going to go really, really well.
But it's also, you know, it is again about Nagakado. You know, whatever about his failures and faults, as we've seen throughout this season, he is very proud of his father, and he always wants to please his father. He always understands that his father is someone that's achieved so much. And when he hears stories about, you know, him winning his first battle at 12 years old, you know, you can tell in his mind he's going, oh, I wish I was just like my dad. Tell me more
stories. Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, this is the tragedy of this episode for Nagakado, is his need, his desire to emulate his father, or be seen in a positive way by his father, by doing something honorable, heroic, whatever that may be. But also he has real true faith in what his father can do, how his father is playing or deciding on his options of what to do. I think he sees this master tactician as his father. He understands that. He's probably been brought up in the court at Edo in Osaka with these tales of, you know, as we do get that kind of flashback to 40 years ago as, you know, the boy warlord who is victorious in battle.
Yeah.
And this is the same thing that is kind of being projected by Nakado himself onto him, that he wants to be this warlord boy, to become a man, this idea to sort of fulfill manhood, but with honor, dignity, like his father has always done. You know, effectively, Toranaga is the classic example of, you know, the graceful swan, but he is pedaling hard and fast underneath the waterline.
Yeah.
You know, not showing his maneuvering, his, and as you say, the third heart element, his true desire,
his true intentions,
intentions of what he's going to do. So I really like that.
Absolutely. But the thing with Nagakado, while he respects everything that his father's doing and his father's trying to teach him and trying to train him, he just has absolutely no patience at all. He is not willing to sit back and take the time that would be required to execute a well-thought-out plan.
That's true, yeah.
Which his father continually tells him, this is what you need to do. You can't act rashly. You can't jump on a moment. You have to make decisions that will pay off for yourself in the future. Play the long game, effectively.
Yeah.
And that is not Nagakado's strong point.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think, although just quickly as well, before we go on to how the dinner develops, really, I did like some of the one of the side conversations between Omi speaking with Buntaro, sort of, in effect, playing devil's advocate, really, a little here Buntaro around Mariko's service to Blackthorn. You know, he knows that Kiku is being hired for a week, and Jin kind of gives him a little bit of a flavor that whilst, you know, Blackthorn's gift of Kiku's services was granted that night he had eyes for someone else and only knows that it was, or deducts that it was Mariko, given she was ordered to be there as well. So I kind of just like him playing that devil's advocate with Buntaro. And of course that plays out over this episode as well. Again, I really like Omi. I like this look at sort of, in a sense, you know, kind of low level, chief of a village, you know, nephew to a much more powerful uncle who, but in his own right is in service to Toranaga. And I like how his machinations as well, but it's just for a different reason to pull him up the ladder. And there is that conversation between him and Nagakado in the hot spring, which I just really, really enjoyed. I love that kind of ruefulness of what's transpired because of their own machinations to become more than what they were at the start of this story.
Exactly.
So I think it's really, really good.
Yeah, Omi's grasping with both hands the opportunity that he's had here to become more powerful like his uncle, you know. I like the comment from Nagakado in the hot springs when Omi's saying, I wish you could just return to some more simple times, because they know that the bad's coming, effectively. Yeah. And Omi's kind of going, I wish we could go back to simpler times. And Nagakado's kind of going, when you were an unknown fishing village and nothing ever happened here, is that what you're looking for? Because you don't seem to want to go back to those times. So Nagakado, understanding that while Omi's saying he wishes it was simpler times, he probably just means, I don't want the threat of death over my head anymore.
Exactly.
That's really what he's waiting for and looking for. Because that comes quite quickly in the dinner here. After these stories and after they're not settling very well with Toranaga's men, Nobutatsu asks to have the negotiation now. They've had their wine, they've had their food. He's not willing to wait for the next day. He's too excited by the offer that could be made.
Yeah, and he's very impatient, you know. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact, you know, well, what will I get for this alliance and for the use of my army?
Yeah.
But it's also in the reveal, in that he knows he's been the offer he's already accepted.
Exactly.
And he absolutely believes that whatever the proposal that comes from Toranaga is not going to match that, because he has been given, you know, one of the top seats at the top table in Japan.
Yeah.
So I really, really enjoyed this kind of sleuthing and, in a sense, a bit of misdirection from Toranaga's half-brother as well.
Yeah, absolutely. But he not only comes armed with the knowledge of the fact that he's the new regent and he's now working for Ishido and he's going to take out Toranaga and his army. That's the first kind of element of it. Toranaga must surrender and be brought back to Osaka with him to answer for his crimes to Ishido. Not only that, Nagakado must also commit seppuku for killing Jozen with the cannons and his men. He has to commit seppuku. He will die because of his uncle's arrival.
But I love that fierce "don't accept it" from Toranaga to his son. I really, really thought that was fantastic little moment of him. You know, again, it's protecting his son from just rushing in, like you say. No kind of... there's no quick calculation being done in Nagakado's mind.
Yeah.
His hand is out for it. And he's like, it's almost don't touch it.
Absolutely.
Don't accept that envelope.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like when the bailiffs come to your door to repossess your house. Don't accept the envelope until you know the detail behind it.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Take a second, take a breath. Toranaga says that he's going to give them an answer the following morning at sunrise, because he's going to take his time to think about exactly how he's going to surrender, I guess. He's going to take that time to ponder and think about exactly what he wants to respond with.
And in many cases, you kind of go, because he's been outmaneuvered here, you know? But also, again, I think to the quality of the discussion between Jin and Toranaga, he doesn't know exactly possibly what is happening or what he's going to do. But I think he is aware that it could go this route. I think Toranaga is someone who plays out all the different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
He's always prepared in some way and is willing to take hold of Lady Luck if it ever comes his way as well.
Absolutely. Well, we're about to get there. Is there anything else about Nobutatsu you want to talk about before we move on to our second Bushido?
I think he's just, he is very confident with what he has been offered by the council.
Yeah.
For him to go strolling into the heartland of his brother.
Oh, yeah.
Even with the decimated army, certainly with that phallic hat, that's a man with confidence.
It certainly is, yes.
Absolutely. And, you know, to play it so kind of calmly, I think.
Yeah, it feels like he's coming along going, not only have I gotten your regency position, I've taken that seat from you, Toranaga. I'm now going to take every single other thing. I'm going to take your son. I'm going to bring you back to surrender to Ishida, which means you will die. And I'm going to take these lands from you as well.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to take everything. He has that power and confidence about him as he walks into the town, and we learn it as the episode goes on. So, yeah, it's an interesting character to bring in here, definitely.
Definitely. But let us get on to our Bushido number two,
yes,
which is that Jin meets Toranaga.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, this is the one you've already mentioned a few times, but it's a really interesting discussion. She gets this meeting with Toranaga in exchange for a slightly reduced rate for Kiku for the week, which Mariko arranged. So that's how she gets this stick of time with Toranaga. It's understood that Toranaga won't have had much opportunity to meet with Jin in the past, but she's asking for just some time of his. The request that she has is really interesting. She's effectively saying that she wants to run a tea room in an area, an actual region reserved for tea rooms in Edo, which will allow the ladies of the real world to live out their lives, because in normal society, they are there for the pleasure of the clients that come into the tea rooms. They give them everything. They give them their life, their youth, their beauty, everything about themselves. And once they are emptied, then they go off to die, effectively. And she wants to have a place where they can all live and live out their life in Edo, in this new town that Toranaga's setting up.
I really enjoyed, you know, that she asks him to bring the Willow World under his protection.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost professionalizing the courtesans.
Yes.
You know, she wants to form a guild of courtesans here. And, you know, Toranaga ultimately is thinking this is all a massive distraction from what effectively has just taken place the night before with his brother, and that his time is very short. But I love that Jin, in effect, it almost feels like she brings him around by giving him a little bit of a pep talk in some way. It's that she, and this is it, you know, it's like she is outside of his inner circle, but in terms of where she's gotten, she is in the courtesan world, at least in this region, equivalent to Toranaga in the political and military world of his circles. You know, it's just they're in different circles. And yes, it's like a bird of a feather, really. There's a shared kind of understanding of how, you know, they got there. Different ways, different means.
Absolutely.
But ultimately, you know, she says, I started off in the gutter and I've made it to being, you know, having this stick of time with a very powerful member of the Council of Regents, or used to be. And, you know, your fate is not sealed until it's done, because in Toranaga saying, you know, I've got very short time here. My fate is, I need to think this through. She can see that in a sense, he's just almost trying to fob her off.
Kind of. I think there's an interesting moment with Nagakado when he's saying, stop bothering us, Jin. Can't you see we've got much more important things? And Toranaga saying, we don't know how many sticks of time we have left. We've made a promise to give her a stick of time. Let's do it right now. I think he's underplaying it the whole time. Yeah. He's trying to tell her, my fate is sealed. I'm giving you this time because, hey, I'm going to be dead tomorrow anyway.
Exactly.
So maybe you're wasting your time by talking to me because I can't do anything for you.
Exactly.
I'm not going to be in power in the future. And she's saying, well, hang on a second. I don't believe the Toranaga that I know would be someone that would give up without a plan. I believe you're putting on this front for everybody to tell them all that you are beaten, that you are broken and you're down, but you've got something else underneath there.
That's it. Like, yeah. She says you are cunning. You know, she ultimately knows that he knows, you know, not the exactness of it, but she knows that there is a cunningness there.
Yeah.
You know, why would someone so cunning, so well prepared, with a network of spies make such a mistake not to see his army coming, even in a depleted state, not to have that knowledge, i.e. that you allowed him to come here for this to play out.
Yeah. And you made it look like he was the powerful one coming into your turn and that you were beaten and you need everything from him. You made that happen. There's a reason behind it. You didn't make this massive...
And I love this. In effectively two very different social classes, but they're at the top of those respective. And
yeah, I think she says she's now the most wealthy courtesan in...
In
all of Issu. So because these people have been stopping off, these very powerful people have been stopping off in this fishing village with the tea room there, she has become this very wealthy lady from all of the visits that they've been getting from these very powerful men. So
I think just through this, it felt like whilst not social equals, an equal of intellect was being exchanged here between the two. And I think, you know, in a sense, when I say a pep talk, it was kind of like that someone would recognize that someone would be still asking of this favor for a new area in this newly built Edo or this purpose, which was really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
But also that just, you know, still that social deference. But what would an old whore know?
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
Because Torunaga is almost like saying, I think you've spoken out of turn here to some extent. I mean, he doesn't say that directly, but...
She wants to make sure that he doesn't say something like that, I guess. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I suppose, I think he's very impressed that she's aware of it, but again, quite worried that somebody could see through that he does have a plan here, because nobody else seems to be seeing that. So potentially he's going, well, I hope she doesn't spill that I have another plan if she's worked it out. But importantly, later on, we do learn that Torunaga has granted the request and will give her land in Edo to do with what she wants. So no matter what happens, that has been signed off.
Yeah, absolutely. So, it was really, really good.
So good.
Like I say, my working theory is because she is both similar and very different to Torunaga and is outside of his inner circle, you know, of honor, of deference and so on. Yes, she can still play that role if she needs to, but she has also scrapped her way to the top of her social circle. And in a sense, as I say, they are birds of a feather, just in very different circles.
Yes, yeah, without a doubt. Oh, such a great scene between
loved
the two of them.
Loved it, absolutely loved it. I thought it was one of the best scenes and just little... It's just so subtly done. I mean, you could almost say this feels like some kind of weird side scene, but I think it really goes to the heart of Torunaga.
Absolutely. And with that, let's get on to Bushido 3, our third major point from the episode. Buntaro wants John's head. We talked a tiny bit about this with the discussion at the dinner table with Omi, but it plays out quite a big way later on in the episode. On the beach, we see that John is trying to work any way to get his ship back, as he has been since the beginning of the season. He's trying to get some way to get his ship back. He has that whole discussion, even with Mariko, going... if I get my ship back, then we'll be able to leave here and we'll be able to do something. America's going to go, and well, what, though? What can you possibly do with your ship in this harbour, basically? And as he stands there looking at his ship, he sees the flag being raised of Ashido on the ship. And somebody else now has taken over and taken over control of his ship. And he meets a pretty angry Yabushiga, who has been made to work with and work for at times the engine since working side by side with Torunaga. And at this time, he's just been told the third thing that Nobutatsu came to the village to say, which was your offer of peace with Ishido has been rejected by returning the head of his lead general.
Exactly.
So he goes down to the beach, looks over at John and goes, maybe it's time for you to give up the pretense that you are a member of the Japanese society just because you stand there wearing the swords, pretending like you have this title of Hatamoto. Take out the swords and fight against me. And they have a small fight between the two of them with Buntaro looking on, and Buntaro suddenly realizes he has a moment here that he may be able to take the head of John Blackthorn. That's a really brutal moment as he's kicked to the ground by Yabushiga, and then Buntaro sticks his sword to John Blackthorne's throat. And John, again, frustrated that he doesn't find a way out here, says to Buntaro, do it. Take my head.
Yeah.
You know?
No, absolutely. Mm. I really like the thing with Yabushige and John Blackthorne mm-hmm. here, because all of Toranaga's allies, they've just seen these different, titles, gifts mm-hmm. being poured onto this barbarian interloper in John Blackthorne. But equally, at the start, we have Blackthorne asking about his role in Crimson Sky with mm-hmm. Toranaga, who has no decision made and really is quite dismissive of him. And Blackthorne's like, I don't understand. You do all these gifts mm-hmm. effectively mean nothing. And that could possibly be the case, that, Toranaga is so powerful, is so wealthy mm-hmm. In terms of his lands and, mm-hmm. and so on, that he is giving them to elicit a response here. He isn't willing to let him sort of just get his ship and be the artillery fire from the harbor on mm-hmm. Osaka. And I think, this is all kind of just these differences, I mean, even with him and Yabushige on the beach, he's like, I'm a pilot of a ship. I don't mm-hmm. know one end of the sword from
exactly.
another.
Exactly. Hold it properly. Two-handed. Okay, that's what you're doing. And again, there's that balance of not understanding everything that Yabushige is saying to him. He doesn't understand all Japanese here, but he's kind of being told enough to understand that Yabushige wants to go mano a mano against him. Yabushige saying to him, another one that John doesn't understand, about you wish you were killed just like your crewmate, boiled and burnt, the one that happened in the first episode. And then just kind of goes, I don't even know why I'm talking to you here, and then they have their fight. But it does bleed into Buntaro, of course, as I said, the sword to the throat. But later we see him going directly to Toranaga in absolute anger, saying the big issue that he has here is how Mariko and John Blackthorne interact. The way that John Blackthorne looks at his wife is why he wants to take his head. And what a conversation here with Toranaga, where Toranaga is saying to him, but if you blame the Anjin, then you must also blame Mariko. She must be at fault if you feel that something happened between the
and
two of them.
And she is your wife, and mm-hmm. you are able to do whatever you want to your wife. You don't need permission.
Mm.
Effectively saying, if you want to take the head of the Anjin, you must also take the head of your wife.
Yeah.
And, which he doesn't want to do
and
here.
And conversely, if he takes her head, he must take John's head as well. Yeah. So
But it's not something he is putting up on the plate as a justification mm-hmm. to this request to Toranaga. And it's actually, in a sense, almost a put down there when Mariko says, well, I am in the service of my husband mm-hmm. and will do whatever he asks.
Yeah.
But he's kind of almost checkmated here a bit. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
By Mariko saying, well, you can take my head if you want to.
Yeah.
Because Buntaro knows that is the one thing he can't do. That's why he has always denied her request to do that, as part of the political maneuverings and machinations that has put her in this place as Buntaro's wife.
Yeah.
And as a result of the death of her father and the seppuku of the rest of her family.
Mm-hmm.
So the one thing he wants to do, which is to kill John Blackthorne, is denied because he is bound not to take his wife's life.
Exactly.
Until effectively her role in this jigsaw is completed to some extent, however that plays out.
So do you think that Buntaro has been denying her request to kill herself because she has a part to play in the future plan of Toranaga, and that's the reason?
I think so. I think that's partly it. Not to say that he knows the intricacies of that plan. He may have just been told, she has to stay alive for as long as possible.
Okay.
And I think, weirdly, maybe there is some affection towards her underneath this gruff, awful exterior of his.
Yeah, because that's what's been going through my head. I know we had a piece of feedback in from Penny Lennox last week, who was quoting the showrunner, Justin Marks, where he made that comment about Buntaro truly loves Madoka, and we haven't seen that on screen. We were saying in our discussion last week in our feedback section that it's something that you just don't see from him at all. He's brutal, he's angry, he's aggressive. But I do think this moment where he comes to Toranaga to tell him he wants John Blackthorne's head is his absolute jealousy of the fact that he hasn't got that relationship with his wife and he believes that he should have that relationship with Mariko. I do think, in his really weird way now, this is the first time we've seen on screen that Buntaro truly loves Mariko.
It's a creak in the door, you know, that's letting some light in.
Yeah.
And in a sense, Mariko in this moment has rejected it by saying, but I am here to serve you. I am yours and you can do effectively what you want.
But that plays into what she wants. She wanted to die.
No, agreed. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But I think there is an element of the Harry Potter pig to slaughter here with Mariko that Toranaga has, even though there is the affection there and so on, and the trust and respect for her.
Yeah.
I think there's that potential for that here, because we know that he has something in mind for her. What that is, I don't know. But, you know, in the sense of why he then asks for Mariko to choose that loyalty, you know, between to him and trust what he is doing and what he is looking for, and whether there is that loyalty to the barbarian of John Blackthorne and her feelings that have, you know, developed over this period.
Yes, Toranaga is looking for absolute loyalty from her, without a doubt. But I suppose it should be said that Buntaro walks away saying his words were just petty. He doesn't want Mariko to die. But that's, I suppose, why I see his view of Mariko is keeping her alive, not allowing her to commit seppuku like she's wanted to since the moment they were married. To me, this feels like Buntaro saying, if I keep her alive long enough, show her that I love her somehow, whatever way that would be. And he goes on the side of being a great warrior, a great member of Toranaga's court. If I show her that, then at some point we will be in love.
Yeah.
Is what it seems like. It's a completely wacko idea that he has. But I feel like this is the only moment I've seen so far of him believing that he loves his wife and wants to take away the person that is staring at her. But I don't know.
Right. Well, it's also the fact that, you know, ultimately Mariko here chooses Toranaga, but she wants to be freed. I mean, she pulls out a katana and he effectively knocks it out of her hands. Like, this is not the moment for this ritual.
Yeah.
And he won't allow it. It feels, you know, increasingly whatever he has planned as a result of the past histories between her father, Achieva's father, and all the politics in between. There's a reason for Mariko to have been paired with Buntaro, who is Hiramatsu's, you know, son. And there is a reason why he is denying this request for death each time, in the same way that Toranaga has knocks out the katana from her hand. So it's just really, really interesting here.
It is, and I just feel that Buntaro is probably not close enough to know Taranaga's plan, and he's been chosen as her husband because he's the type of person that will make sure she stays alive and not allow her to kill herself or commit seppuku. I think that's where this leads, and that moment where he goes, oh, I'm sorry, I spoke too soon, my words are petty, and steps away. He's embarrassed by the idea that he's just gone to Toranaga over jealousy, effectively.
Yeah.
So I think that's where that sits. But you're absolutely right. That conversation that Toranaga had with Mariko last episode, where he said, there is a plan, there is a future for you, there is a plan for you, that's being underlined by the scene here, where he's frustrated that there could be something there where John Blackthorne's wants and needs and desires may take precedence over Lord Taranaga, because she has a part to play in his plan. So that'd be interesting to see how that plays out in the next episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's go on to Bushido number 4. A short one here, but a massive moment, a huge moment. Taranaga's answer to the ultimatum that has been brought to his town by Nobutatsu. I just like the pageantry of this almost as well as everything else. Toranaga says he will give the answer the following morning at sunrise. He lines up with all of his generals, all in their full regalia, each one of them, their full war outfits, to sit and listen to the answer of Toranaga that he gives to his half-brother. And the answer that he gives is that he will submit to Ishido's orders. He will allow himself to be taken back to Osaka and effectively face death here once again. It's very likely Mariko explains to John Blackthorne earlier on that if he goes back, he will die, and at least half of his men will have to commit seppuku because of their lord and master. So and him dying. So this is a huge moment.
It is, absolutely. It feels like he is crumpling to the will of the council that is now headed by Ishido, but it's also crucially controlled by Ishiba, very subtly, we've seen, you know, very subtle in her sort of direction of Ishiba.
Absolutely.
You can see it comes as a shock to his generals, certainly to his son.
Well, absolutely. They didn't really mention it, though, interestingly, because, again, if he submits and his son has been told to commit seppuku for the murder of Jozen, that means he's also allowing his son to commit seppuku, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
He doesn't answer that, though. I thought there would be a mention of that, but he's effectively saying it's a no-win scenario. The idea of the Crimson Sky will not happen. The Crimson Sky was the attack that they were going to have on Osaka, one massive outright fight using the armies that he was amassing together after the attack on Osaka to save the people and save Japan. That won't happen now. He's submitting to the will of Ishido, and he is going to bend the knee effectively. So while there is bad reactions from his generals around who didn't believe that this was a decision that Torunaga would make, they always feel that something in the back pocket for Torunaga. John is the one that reacts so significantly.
Yeah, I think this is equally significant from John's perspective as it is from, and I think it's equal to sort of the other realization that Jin has, or, you know, knowledge that innate sort of connection as to how Torunaga is playing this.
Yeah.
You know, and I think, again, it's because he is the outsider. I mean, he is the classic outsider from another country sort of peering in through to these customs and so on. Mm. You know, he doesn't have that lifelong family sort of connections here with the Torunagas, and, you know, I think this is where, you know, he's like, as he says, of course no one other than Mariko can understand him really,
but
effectively, you know, in front of everyone said, you know, behold the master of trickery who is willing to lead all his vassals to death, you know, pointing at them.
Well, yeah. They can't understand the first part of that, but John makes sure they understand the last part of that. He points at them all and says, in Japanese, you will all die.
Yeah.
Every one of you will die because of this decision. John knows he's only alive here because of his alliance with Torunaga and because of working with Torunaga. Torunaga's kept him alive in situations where he couldn't possibly have been kept alive. You know, remember back when he was in Osaka, Torunaga put him in prison and got him back out and they escaped from Osaka together. John would not have survived there if it was up to Ishido. We know Ishido wanted to kill him back when they were there. So here he is nailing his flag to the mast saying, I am part of Torunaga's army. You use me whatever way you want to use me. I am here for whatever fate decides for ourselves. Yeah. And was told, I haven't even thought of a plan for you, by Torunaga. And here he is, having effectively laid down the offer to do anything for Torunaga, and now being told Torunaga's going to give up. He's going to walk away. Don't worry about it. All my men are going to die, probably including you. I didn't even have a decision for what I wanted to use you for in the war.
Well, it's interesting because as he walks away, just, you know, under his breath, he says, you know, crimson bloody horseshit. Mm-hmm. I.e., crimson sky is a pile of horseshit.
Yeah.
It is like this red herring almost, potentially.
Yeah.
This notion of, you know, this huge full frontal attack on the walled city of Osaka and its castle, you know.
And the simple fact of it is that Torunaga lost more than half of his army. So how could they have done Crimson Sky on their own? And then the only other option that they had was bringing in the half-brother to join up and bring in his armies, so they would have a greater army, and maybe with the remnants of Torunaga's army and his half-brother's army, maybe with those two combined, they could have still done Crimson Sky, but his half-brother has denied him and said he has to go and give himself up to Ishida. So John kind of going, hang on a second here, you had this great plan. but how could you ever possibly be carrying it out? And you led us all along to stand by your side, and he's the only one that really stands up and does it. I think this is massively brave of John to call him out. What kept going through my head was Fuji's husband back from episode one, who stood up and stepped into the room because of the disrespect he felt like Toranaga was getting from some of the regents, and he ended off having to commit seppuku and kill his child. Fuji's only just about alive because of being saved by Hiramatsu. I kept thinking of that and going, look at John here standing up in the middle of all of the warlords of the region and telling them all they're all going to die because they're following Toranaga. That's a massively disrespectful thing to say in front of all these people. I know he's looked at as the barbarian, so they're probably not going to put him to death for the slight there, but it seemed like a massively brave thing to do in that room, because someone's going to take offense to that, or someone...
Oh, absolutely, I think so.
Yeah, could take it out in John in the future. Yeah. And then we have almost a post-credit. I thought that's where the episode would end with John's Crimson Sky bullshit. But it goes on to what is our Bushido 5, Nagakado's last stand.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I think two things in the lead-up to this. You know, I mentioned earlier about Omi and Nagakado in the hot springs. You know, Omi lamenting about what's been lost, you know, to reach for more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But Nagakado wants to act, wants to do more, you know, for glory and honor kind of thing.
Mm.
He's overheard by his uncle, you know, who this sort of race for war for an honorable death, and he, you know, he just kind of says death is but a lonely walk in the woods. I mean, even earlier, you know, Toranaga is why, you know, says to his son, why is it people who have never been to war are the ones that are most lustful for going into warfare?
Isn't there that moment where Nagakado says to his uncle when he's bathing in the springs, he says to him, I hear that your first kill is better than the first time you pillow with a woman. And I think is a really good representation. I really like this character in the show, but he is that representation of the 16-year-old who goes to war in an army that accepts 18-year-olds and falsifies their documents so they can go to war.
Exactly.
Because they've been told it's such an honourable thing to do. Of course, much respect to the armed forces that go around the world, but a 16-year-old should not be running out to join the armed forces. They should not be falsifying documents. There's a reason why you need to be old enough to make those decisions. And Nagakado is that one who's been looking at all of these adventures in his mind. And no matter how many of those older representatives of wartime factions, that people like his father and his uncle and Yabushiga, no matter how many of them tell him, it is not all the stories that you've been told. There's much more to it. No matter how many of them tell him that, Nagakado wants to go out there and get his first kill and get his glorious legacy started.
It's his position, and it's what I was saying before about, you know, the tragedy of him is this look to his father all the time, but never taking on board the caution or the wise words of his father.
Yeah.
You know, and with Nagakado as well, there's also a more personal note here when we see him with Fuji, you know, and he's saying it should have been him that stood up to Ishido with the insult towards his father, not her husband.
Yeah.
You know, I should have been braver.
Mm-hmm.
He rues that, but ultimately I don't think he would wanted to have done that. He knew that overstepping the mark into that council would have been seppuku. So, you know, he tempered it, but there's still that regret that it wasn't him that had that honourable death.
Yeah.
You know, his willingness to put his hand out to reach for the letter that tells him to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is all the tragedy of Nagakado, really, I think.
Absolutely, and as we said, regardless of whether he stood up to Ishido at the beginning of the season, the fact that he blew up Jozen and his army with cannonballs has also led them to the same place as Fuji's husband.
Yeah.
But in that conversation, she tells him, we do what we can when we can. It's not bravery. You take those choices in the moments that you take them because you can at that moment. But if the timing's not right, effectively, there's no point in doing something different. But I do think that spurs him on to his choice here.
Absolutely. We do what we can when we can and hope that it's enough.
Yes.
You know? And in a sense, yes, I completely agree. This kind of spurs him on to taking matters effectively into his own hands by leading then the attack on the tea house where Nobutatsu is with Fuji.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's like coordinated with Fuji, who seems to leave to you know.
Yeah.
So
I feel like, yeah, I think she knows she says to him after their bondage sex, I guess, that she has loads more toys available. I'm just going to go out and get them.
Go and get them.
Now, you stay here.
Yeah. And ultimately, this moment leads to tragedy as, you know, he's chasing down Nagakata, who's fallen into the pond. As he goes to make the killing blow on his uncle, you know, he slips on a rock, which has his uncle's dressing gown or gown on it, falls back and effectively cracks his head open and kills himself. And you do have that kind of then reflection from that hot spring talk when Nobutatsu says, "And where is the beauty in this?" You know, in a sense, it's quite rueful as to what's happened. Completely shocking. I mean, this is the thing. This is like, okay, so effectively the heir to Torunaga has just clumsily killed himself.
Yeah.
And presumably with no sanction from his father.
Absolutely.
So, you know, it was just really, really shocking. Like, how is this going to change things?
Yeah, exactly. And also, looking at Nagakata's plan, once again, it's not a very good strategic plan anyway. Going after Nobutatsu and killing him wouldn't solve any of the things that Torunaga has to face. It wouldn't solve the fact that Ishido is calling him back to Osaka to answer for his crimes. It wouldn't solve the fact that Nagakata has been told to commit seppuku. It just kills another person. That's all it does. If he had been successful, somebody else would have been sent. So, once again, no thinking of the long term, just thinking with that idea of the story he's heard as a child.
Yeah.
And that's it. It's an awful way to go. Really shocking. Really surprising. Even though we've kind of seen this is the rashness of Nagakata right from the start. It's an awful way to go, but that's why the reaction of Nobutatsu is so interesting. He's not, I don't know, happy about the fact that he survived or anything like that. He's just looking at his nephew lying dead, going, "There's no beauty in this death."
Yeah, and really, you know, it's his. You see his final breath. As well, like it's really tragic. You know, a life lost. Yeah. Too soon, too early. In that sense, so
exactly.
You know, really, sort of big ending. Shocking ending, really. Yeah. Not, I mean, even if he had succeeded and killed Nobutatsu, you know, that would have been shocking.
Absolutely.
He would have gone after him and succeeded. So, like, just really interesting, as you say, kind of almost epilogue of this episode. Really, really good.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just one other quick thing I want to talk about. It's kind of a note from the episode, but it is the story of Torunaga's first battle, because I kind of think it's important. It ties in a little bit with this last point. But it's the battle 46 years earlier where Hiramatsu and Torunaga are proclaimed the winners of the war, effectively. That's his first battle at the age of about 12.
Yeah.
And it goes throughout the episode. And I think the reason why they tie it in throughout the episode is because it goes to that concept of the stories told of war and how true or untrue they are. There's an entire army involved in Torunaga's battle, of course, but it's Torunaga that is proclaimed the winner of this war.
Yeah, the boy warlord.
Yeah.
By his beaten foe here.
Exactly, yeah. Mizuguchi,
yeah.
Who formally surrenders and then asks this 12-year-old to be his second while he commits seppuku. And the story has gone down the generations now, 46 years it's been told, and the story being told by his brother, his half-brother at the dinner table is that this amazing 12-year-old warlord chopped off the head of his enemy with one strike.
Yeah.
And we hear later with Hiramatsu and Toranaga that actually it was more like 9. There was blood everywhere. He was hacking at it for ages. How did these stories get out there? How did this become the pervading story that everybody tells?
Exactly. And Toranaga says, you know, who would pick a 12-year-old boy to be their second?
What an idiot. Yeah.
You know.
But you can tell, and again, the reason why I think that story is, you see the flashbacks to it a few times, you hear it being told in different ways throughout the episode. I think the reason why it's there is because these are the types of stories that inspire someone like Nagakata. These are the things that make Nagakata, who's 16 or 17 at this stage, kind of go, well, I'm 5 years behind my father, who was so amazing in war that he was able to chop off his enemy's head with one fell swoop. I should be doing things like this by now.
It's the history of events by
the winner.
By the winner as well. You know, I mean, interestingly, you know, it's the same as a lot of William Shakespeare's plays and how it, you know, builds up the Tudors or the House of Lancaster, which they, you know, to give the legitimacy through tales and stories, you know, certainly in terms of the War of the Roses, you know, or and anything that links into those types of plays that Shakespeare wrote. It basically said the Lancastrians won. It was the House of Tudor, is, you know, from that line, they are the legitimate monarch. I mean, it's all that feeding into that history, the propaganda.
Creating a legend more than
creating
history.
Creating a legend, creating something that can't be challenged. And if it is, you can claim, well, a traitor, you know, betrayal. And it's just really, but, you know, Shakespeare to the masses. So it's that kind of similar thing. I totally agree. That's why it's there. It's the difference between reality and what is used for political purposes, ultimately, or, you know, the legend of Toranaga.
Yeah. Exactly. The only other note I have from the episode is just about Fuji and Hiramatsu's discussion.
Yeah.
Hiramatsu brings back the ashes of her husband and son to Fuji, and Fuji tells Hiramatsu that she's delighted to be reunited with them. And once this war is over, effectively, she says, when Toranaga loses, I'll be able to take my own life and be with them, be ashes with them as well. Which is a bit of a surprise, which is a massive surprise, really, for Hiramatsu. Again, she was spared by Toranaga in his mind. She didn't have to commit seppuku because of the slight of her husband, which would be the standard practice. She's been kept alive, and Hiramatsu is shocked to find that she wants to take her own life afterwards.
Yeah.
But also very surprised that she's thinking that Toranaga is not going to win this war. Hiramatsu is absolutely convinced, regardless of what's going on here, he's convinced his lord will win the war. He's worked with him for, as we saw, 46 years, right, since his first battle. So he's standing right by his side. And I think there's a moment there with Fuji when he says that to her, when he says, you know, do you believe our lord won't win? She goes, uh-oh, hang on a second. that's the right-hand man. That's the man-at-arms of Toranaga. Exactly. I probably said the wrong thing here. No, I will live in glory after our lord Toranaga wins. You know, she suddenly changes her tune quite well, quite quickly there. So I thought that was quite an important moment for Hiramatsu. As we've seen, he's sacrificed a lot to be side by side with Toranaga throughout this season. Yeah. And the idea that Fuji would be another person that would take her own life if Toranaga loses just seems like a shock to him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I guess that's it for the episode. Toranaga here in an unwinnable situation has declares that that's it. He's
submitting to the council.
Yeah. So will Fuji be right, I guess, or will Hiramatsu be right? Is there something that we haven't learned so far? Is this all part of Toranaga's plan? I think there was a plan. But is there a plan now after Nagakata has died?
Be interesting.
Yeah. I think Jin was right that he had a plan, but it's interesting. Will his plan still be available, I guess, or still play out now that his son has died the way he has? Overall, John, what did you think of this episode, this chapter?
I really loved this episode. Give it 5 old, clever, insightful whores out of 5. I absolutely loved the stick in time between Jin and Toranaga. I thought, you know, that meeting of, in a sense, intellectual equals, despite being from very different social spectrums. And that formal ceremonial answer to his half-brother, you know, calling out this master of trickery, Jin calling out his cunning, and that he wouldn't just leave it open like this to be doing effectively what he does, which is to surrender and submit to the council and Ishido. So I think there's still something there, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's just really great, those moments. I loved all the different through lines here with Buntaro and Mariko. With John Blackthorne, sort of, what am I doing here? How am I going to help? To him sort of storming off, talking about, you know, this crimson bloody horseshit. You know, it's all just a ruse in a sense. And I guess another English word would be, you know, it's bollocks. This is what's happening here is bollocks. It's not what you think it is, effectively.
It is interesting. We didn't mention it in the discussion itself, but it is interesting that the episode starts with John being dragged out like a puppy almost to say his phrase, saying, "I'm really happy to meet the blood relative of my lord and master Toranaga." At the introduction of Nobutatsu, says it all in Japanese, you know. So he comes out and does his party trick effectively, and then sent away. And here at the end, he's standing in front of Nobutatsu, in front of Lord Taranaga, saying, "Everybody here is going to die. Decision of Toranaga's is the worst decision," you know. So interestingly, it went from the start where he was being called, you know, a tamed barbarian, to the end when he is effectively shouting like a barbarian to everybody, saying, "You're all going to die."
No, so, absolutely.
Interesting.
I really like, you know, the tragedy of Nagakado here. As well as the more sort of ruefulness, lamenting of almost melancholic of Omi. But, you know, Nagakado is the one where, you know, he looks up to his father. He wants to be the boy warlord. The flashback that we see that flashback, you know, is in a sense a purified one that has been sort of nuanced and sort of in a sense made bloodless over time, to, you know, talk up the power that the tactical ability of Toranaga, even as a child. And Nagakado's need to always seem to be rushing in to fight, to the battle, to war, and never listening to those people that caution against it. I mean, in a sense, you know, the context of this is that with the Taiko, it's been many hundreds of years of civil war in Japan. Tons of blood has been shed. What you see with Toranaga, every sage is trying to limit him going on the field of battle to face his enemies, to circumvent it, to come through a Machiavellian type approach to win through more peaceful methods, or to limit the amount of fighting that there will be.
Exactly.
And this goes against, and this is opposite to how Nagakado thinks of him in a sense. And yet, you know, the tragedy is that in rushing into fight, he dies. But in no honorable or glorious way, he slips on a stone and cracks his head open. And you know, that poetic sort of reflection from his uncle, Nobutatsu, of where is the beauty in this? It's just so good. I loved how this all interlaced in this episode. So for me, I give this 5 old, clever, and insightful whores out of 5.
Absolutely.
Go Jin.
Yep. Definitely agree with you. That's it's a fantastic episode. Another one which is so well written, so well acted. An entire episode of people sitting around talking, and it is another, it could have been an entire battle episode.
I thought that is exactly what was happening. I didn't realize until you got, you know, 40 years ago. I thought, oh, heck, you know, something's happened here.
Here's a massive battle coming up. But I think there's no, it's no lesser for that. The writing is so on point that I'm drawn into every scene. I cannot wait for chapter 8 next week. Really looking forward to it. We do have a little bit of feedback in on last week's episode on chapter 6 of Shogun. Dr. Bob Phillips sent us in a message on Facebook who says, "The world is being shook up. All the tentative circling the Great Bears has been replaced with the swiping of claws and the gnashing of jaws. It has to be that the Honourable wins out. But will Toranaga manage to make Crimson Sky with diamonds? Well, cannonball from the docks work. The deeply intimate story of Mariko builds beautifully here too. The flashbacks and the perfectly linear positions set by the courtesan after she signaled her knowledge. While Blackthorn is giving us the ability to see this world, relegating him to mostly an excuse for us to observe balances of power in a way few shows about other cultures I've seen have ever done." Totally agree with you, Dr. Bob. I think the way they're using John Blackthorne throughout this show, it's just exceptional. It's so good to have him this way as himself trapped within a culture that he doesn't understand at times. He's not our viewpoint character. He's the one that we see in the background. We get his experiences, but we also get the experiences of all of the other characters. We can see what's going on. We can hear it in their voices from what they're experiencing.
Yeah.
It's not just John looking at them and explaining to us, the audience, what's happening. So I think it's really, really good the way they've used him in the show. It's so different, thankfully, from so many other shows who take the exact same approach every time. I'm the foreigner. It's a fish out of water story in another culture. It's not. It's
and
not
I'm
like
here
that.
To save you. As
yeah,
well.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, absolutely.
Yeah. That's not going to happen with John when he's calling them out to all die under Toranaga's rule.
Absolutely. I mean, and totally agree with you, Dr. Bob. It's the observation of Japanese culture, and I mean the whole scene in the tea room. And I think, you know, when Mariko and Fuji are setting up that deal with Jin for Fuji to spend time with Blackthorn, you know, it's all just so well observed, really interesting.
Absolutely.
You know, I mean, as I said at the time, just that close-up of the kind of teacup, you know, and the porcelain, it's just like, it's really fascinating, and it's fantastically done.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thanks so much, Dr. Bob. If you want to send any feedback into us, you can email us to feedback@tvpodcastindustries.com, or of course, pop over to our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/TV Podcast Industries. You can join us there. We have a spoiler post up for each episode as they come out each week. We will be back next Tuesday with our chat all about Shogun Chapter 8, The Abyss of Life. Ooh.
That's very deep.
Yeah, it does, especially after, of course, Toranaga losing his son in this episode. It sounds like it's going to be a tough watch.
I think so.
Mm.
But cannot wait to see it.
Absolutely.
As this series of Shogun just keeps delivering and delivering. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much, fellow warriors, for joining us, as always, with our discussions around Shogun. Until next week, keep watching and, of course, keep listening.
Speak to you next time. Bye.
Bye.